www.srn.org. In Philadelphia, I'm Dante Tosa, sitting in for Aldo Pagado.
And you've just finished listening to Free Speech Radio News here on Community Radio WEFT 90.1 FM. You can hear Free Speech Radio News each and every weekday as part of the WEF Courier, which is your daily weekday dose of independent alternative news, information, and analysis. It starts off at 4 o'clock with Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez from Pacifica in New York. Then 5 o'clock it is Free Speech Radio News, followed by a different program of news analysis at 5:30. Today that's Media Geek, that's me, Paul Riesmandel, with news of our media environment. Then at 6 o'clock, rolling in for the music. Artists and bands will be in the Champaign Urbana area in the near future. Dave will play them for you, tell you what they're going to be so you can find out if you want to see them. And if you can, you can see them. Then at 8 o'clock, Best of Blues played live, only here on Community Radio. Help us celebrate the beginning of our 25th year on air by joining us for WEF Fest 2006 on Saturday, September 16th. The music begins at 2 p.m., broadcast live from the WEF studios in Mike and Molly's Beer Garden, directly down Market Street in downtown Champaign. Mark your calendars for WEF Fest 2006, Saturday, September 16th, with music, food, and festivities in celebration of 25 years of community radio in East Central Illinois. And the views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, station manager, or Prairie Incorporated, not even the WEFT associates. Now stay tuned for Media Geek.
There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I'm your host. On today's program, an allegedly progressive garment maker issues an ultimatum to an independent magazine. The garment makers American Apparel, and they're threatening to sue Clamor Magazine over a section of their fall issue dedicated to exposing some of the dirty underside of that anti-sweatshop t-shirt manufacturer. And we'll also catch up with the media news, including Radio and Revolution in Oaxaca, Mexico. Do stay tuned. Congress's August recess is just about to end, and while many senators were back in their home districts during the week of August 28th, network neutrality activists took the opportunity to confront their elected officials on the issue. Rallies in 25 cities across the country were held to tell senators that their constituents want a free and open internet without additional fees for multimedia content. The rallies were held to support the Internet Freedom Preservation Act, sponsored by Senator Byron Dorgan, a North Dakota Democrat, and Senator Olympia Snowe, a Maine Republican. The act was defeated as an amendment to the larger Senate telecom bill, but Senators Dorgan and Snowe are expected to reintroduce it if that telecom bill goes to the Senate floor for a full vote. Senators get back to work on September 5th with a pretty heavy schedule, and it's still not known if the Senate will be taking up the big telecom bill, whose primary purpose is to create the national cable TV franchise for AT&T and Verizon. According to the Save the Internet Coalition, 26 senators have publicly announced their support for the Snowe-Dorgan bill. Four of them did so in the midst of the nationwide rallies. In Oaxaca, Mexico, has been the site of an ongoing popular uprising incited by the Mexican government's violent attack on striking teachers who occupied the center of Oaxaca City from May 22nd until June 14th, when police staged a pre-dawn raid on the teachers' tent city. Radio has been an important tool used by the teachers and the popular movement. Unlicensed radio has been a regular fixture in Oaxaca, with as many as 36 stations regularly appearing on the airwaves. The teachers have used a station named Planton during their labor actions, and after the violent police attack on June 14th, students at a local university turned over the use of their student-run station to the teachers to bring Planton to a larger audience. After the widely disputed Mexican presidential election on July 2nd, a Revolutionary People's Assembly was declared by a diverse cross-section of Oaxacan society. The assembly declared the entire political structure ruled by the PRI for the last 80 years to be illegitimate, but they were largely ignored by commercial and state-run media. Since then, the popular movement has taken over and occupied as many as 10 different commercial radio stations. As of August 26th, two stations are still occupied, broadcasting in Oaxaca City and Colonia Reforma. The latter station, named La Ley, was the site of the murder of Lorenzo San Pablo Cervantes, a 52-year-old public works employee who was standing guard outside the station. According to Narco News, Cervantes was shot and killed by pro-government thugs in a pre-dawn attack on the station on the morning of August 11th. Despite this, La Ley is still broadcasting, as is the teacher's radio Planton. On August 24th, Mexican presidential candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador announced that beginning September 16th, there will be two presidents in Mexico. All indications that all forms of media will be important tools in this battle over the future of Mexico, as the people in states like Oaxaca attempt to communicate the truth of what is happening in the streets through the media blockade erected by state-controlled and corporate media. The website narconews.com has continued to provide consistent and unflinching news and accounts from Oaxaca. There are links to Narco News and other stories on the situation at the Media Geek website at mediageek.net. That's a bit of what's going on in our media environment, and this is Media Geek. You just heard the website name. You can also get the radio program there at radio.mediageek.net. You can also subscribe to the podcast to get the program automatically downloaded to your computer in the MP3 or open source Ogg Vorbis format, so you can catch the show, whether it's online, whether it's on your MP3 player, or whether it's on the radio, however you like it, all at MediaGeek.net. If you have any comments about the program, anything you'd like to hear more of, anything you'd like to hear less of, I'm all for it. I'd love to hear about it. Send me email, paul@MediaGeek.net. So Clamor Magazine is a scrappy but very successful magazine that started out in Bowling Green, Ohio, bringing lots of new voices to magazine publishing, often with a very progressive political agenda. With their fall issue of 2006, they decided to take on American Apparel Manufacturing. American Apparel has gotten to be very well known, especially amongst hip youngsters, not like myself, and amongst a lot of liberals because they have an anti-sweatshop stance. They also feature fairly sexy advertising, which a lot of people are saying degrades and is objectifying to women. And American Apparel has struck back, threatening to sue Clamor Magazine for their coverage. Clamor is a $150,000 a year organization. American Apparel made $250 million in profit last year. So I talked to Jen Angel, who is a founder and co-publisher at Clamor Magazine, to have her tell us more about this situation and how they're dealing with it.
Well, we decided to start looking into the company American Apparel. They make T-shirts and other types of clothing, and we've used them in the past to print our own T-shirts. And the main reason we've done that is because they have an anti-sweatshop image. They pay their workers well and things like that. So we had also been hearing some other things about them, so for our own purposes, just because we bought their T-shirts, and because we know a lot of other people who do, we decided to start looking in the company. And what we found out was there's a lot of other reasons, even though they are sweatshop-free, not to support the company, because they have some other unsavory practices, like they're anti-union, they have advertising that objectifies women, and the founder has several sexual harassment suits against him, and those are some things that we thought were important for American Apparel's customers to know. So about 2 weeks ago, the company heard that we were going to be doing this report or section or whatever. And so we started getting calls and emails from their media relations director. Her name is Cynthia Seaman. And she wasn't too happy about it. And she sent us a letter saying if we didn't retract the section that they would threaten us with legal action. And so that has basically developed into like a two-week kind of ongoing battle with them so far. So that's kind of the background.
So are there specific charges that are made in the articles that they're identifying as objectionable?
Well, they said that the first letter we received from Cynthia Seaman was very sweeping, saying there are all these factual inaccuracies and that everything was wrong. And we have done some. At that time, the only thing that she brought up was we actually made a mistake and conflated two sexual harassment charges into one, and we said that this woman, Mary Nelson, had withdrawn her sexual harassment suit, but that case is actually still pending. So we printed that correction on our website, and then they said, okay, well, there's other inaccuracies, and they sent to us just last Friday about a six-page letter saying, highlighting what they thought was wrong. And some of the things are basically just their version of the story. Like, she basically laid out, our first article discusses the Unite Union's attempt to unionize their factory in Los Angeles. And they basically, American Apparel basically gave us their version of the story. And it's kind of developing into a he said, she said type situation. We, you know, definitely support our version because we interviewed people from Unite and talked to, you know, union organizers and got their perspective, and we support their perspective is valid. And, you know, American Apparel can have their perspective. That's fine, too. Some of the stuff that they have said was we made a – they said that the claim that the founder, Dov Charney, is a masturbatory exhibitionist is defamatory. But – Dove does not dispute having masturbated in front of a reporter from Jane Magazine. So I can't really, you know, we can't say that's defamatory because it's true, and he's admitted to have done that, you know. You know, they brought up all these really little minor facts that we supposedly got wrong, and one of them was that we said their factory building was built in the 40s, and it was actually built in the 20s. But what the author actually said was the building looks straight out of the 40s, which is not saying it was built in the 40s. So that was, you know, those types of errors. We did have an argument over some other minor facts. We said that Dov Charney went to school in the 90s. He actually went in the 80s. That was probably a typo. And then we said that the business was founded in 1998, and it was actually founded in 1997, but we actually have sources. We have a reason for saying it was in 1998, and so we'll correct that because they claim that it's wrong, but, you know, we believed it to be true at the time that we printed. So what we really want is for readers to kind of make up their own minds by reading our reports and reading other stuff that's widely available. There's a very extensive report available on the Internet at a website called KnowMore, KnowMore.org, where the writer actually spent like 6 months investigating American Apparel. And he goes in and talks a lot about the Unite union drive, and he puts out some criticisms of the union, which are totally valid, but he also puts a lot of really damning stuff in there about American Apparel and the way that they acted. Managers or people believed to have authority within the company, you know, told employees that Dove didn't want a union, and they hosted like an anti-union rally on the clock in their parking lot, you know, those types of things. And I've talked to other people off the record who have said that the level of intimidation of workers is so high that no one will come forward on the record to say about these experiences because they're afraid of getting fired. The good thing about American Apparel is they do pay a higher than average wage. The average wage at their company is $12 an hour, which is really good for the garment industry, and a lot of people don't, you know, they're in a financial position, they can't give that up. One thing I wanted to mention, though, is I've talked to a lot of media outlets who have experienced similar tactics from American Apparel where they have tried to get these media outlets to not publish a critical story. And we're having difficulty getting those outlets to come forward. And right now we're working with a couple of them to encourage them to come forward and go on the record, because this is a pattern that American Apparel has, that they're attempting to silence their critics by, you know, intimidating them and threatening them with lawsuits. They threatened us twice, you know, and it's like, you know, another company may think twice about ever covering American Apparel again. And some of the, you know, other magazines and outlets that I've talked to have said, well, we already went through that. We don't want to talk about American Apparel again because we'll invite their scrutiny, and we don't want to deal with that. It took too much time and energy from us.
Are these mainstream outlets? Are these more independent outlets?
Both.
Both. Do they simply back down from legal threats? Is that the essence of it?
Some of them, you know, printed a retraction or a correction, or then later printed a, you know, a more nicer story about American Apparel. But I think the greater problem is that there's this chilling effect that those outlets certainly will no longer cover American Apparel because they know that they'll be threatened again. And they're like, well, you know, even if a legitimate story comes up, it's like, why would they do that again? You know, so there's this chilling effect of media outlets covering companies like American Apparel because they think they'll be threatened.
And so, in essence, I mean, you know, even if it's a larger publication, it's really a matter of hassle, if nothing else. They simply don't want to deal with it.
At the most basic level, yes.
Hmm. And I think that's something that maybe a lot of people don't realize, because the press likes to portray itself as, you know, sticking up for the truth and sticking up for stories. I don't think a lot of people realize that very often behind the scenes, a newspaper, magazine, or television show will be intimidated out of doing stories by these sorts of threats.
Right. Or are they just, you know, like if the idea comes up, you know, say something happens in American Apparel and somebody brings it up as it pitches it as a story, you know, someone may be like, oh, let's not do that because remember what happened last time, you know. And other media outlets, certainly ones that are smaller, like Clamor, we don't have the funding to, you know, have attorneys. We don't have a legal team, and you know, we don't have all of our content reviewed by an attorney before it goes out. And, you know, it places a significant burden on us when we have to deal with this.
And have you heard from a lawyer from American Apparel?
No. The media relations woman has said repeatedly that we're going to hear from their attorneys, but we haven't yet. Partially, I believe it's because, you know, your defense against a defamation or a libel claim is that what you printed is true. And so the stuff that they claim is the most defamatory, such as, you know, the statements about Dove and the masturbating and things like that, those are true statements. And there was another quote in our article where there's a quote attributed to Dove Charney where he says that he believes that most domestic violence is initiated by women. And American Apparel's press woman says that Dove never said that, okay? But a simple search of the Internet will find that that quote is widely attributed to Dove Charney, and he's quoted in an interview in the McGill Daily saying that. So we didn't print it knowing it was false. We printed it believing it was true, and we have, you know, the sources to say where we found it from. So, you know, if they were to sue us, they would need to prove, one, that we knew it was wrong, and two, that we printed it anyways with malicious intent, which I think would be difficult for them to prove.
If American Apparel were to want to bring a lawsuit, that would be something difficult for Clamor to defend.
It would be, because we don't have, you know, an attorney. We have one who's consulting with us now, which is nice. And it wouldn't be difficult for us to defend, because, you know, we have our writers and they have their sources and their notes from when they wrote the articles, and they could say, well, this is where I got that from, and I believed it was true at the time. So I think it'd be more difficult for American Apparel to prove that we knew it was wrong and that we printed it anyways.
The problem is really resource, really.
Yeah. Then, because, you know, they could sue us anyways, knowing that they couldn't win. They could sue us anyways just to make our life hell and possibly put us out of business, even if we would win eventually.
And so when Clamor decided to take on this set of stories, really, I mean, did you know already about American Apparel's intimidation tactics?
We didn't, because most media outlets haven't come forward. And it was only after American Apparel started approaching us that we found out that this had happened to other people. mainly by those outlets coming to us and being like, hey, the same thing happened to us, let me tell you about it, but off the record. We honestly, nothing in our section is groundbreaking. It's not like this amazing investigative journalism uncovering all this new material that hasn't been printed anywhere. Most of it is, you know, out there and available through a variety of media sources. So we were actually really surprised when we heard from American Apparel, because we felt like we were doing a service to our market, our customers and readers, by saying, look, here's the company that you buy from. Here's some things that you may want to know about. We didn't think that American Apparel would even pay attention to us, because it's not like we're, you know, levying any new allegations or, you know, making claims that haven't been made elsewhere. So we were surprised.
And one of the things, and one of the press releases that you put out, I read, is to sort of say that American Apparel has kind of gotten a pass from perhaps the liberal left or the progressive left. I mean, how so?
Well, we think that American Apparel has really made its way in the world by appealing to progressives who want to support their anti-sweatshop image, which is really great. You know, like supporting companies that provide jobs for, you know, good wage in the U.S. is good. But we don't want to support a company that, you know, creates an atmosphere where, you know, sexual harassment is permissible, where, you know, supervisors have sex with their employees, and where they use this advertising that's pretty objectionable. It's like, that's not a company that we want to support. So we have printed T-shirts, printed our shirts on American Apparel stock in the past, because we really like the shirt and think it's a great product. But now that we know all of this other stuff about American Apparel, we're not going to be purchasing them anymore. And it's the same with any other company. If we found out that they had, you know, unsavory business practices, then we would stop purchasing from them.
And so have you gotten any other reactions so far from the story, either negative or positive?
We've gotten a lot of reaction. Most of our readers and people who have found out about us through the press that we've gotten have been pretty supportive, mostly because a lot of people are aware of these issues and, you know, have said, oh, I've heard about this before, or I read this other report, you know, or things like that. The only kind of real negative things we've gotten are from American Apparel. And also, I kind of find this hard to believe, but American Apparel has a staff person who basically, like, looks around on the internet and posts on blogs, and this person is, like, posted on our blog repeatedly. And I guess I can't believe that that's someone's job, you know? So they, you know, they're posting a lot of stuff trying to discredit us and tell us that, you know, tell our readers that we don't know what we're talking about and things like that. So that's been a little frustrating because we haven't really done the same thing. It's not like we're posting our story on all these different blogs and things like that. It's like we only started publicizing it once American Apparel started threatening us.
So aside from this one, I guess, American Apparel web surfer, have you gotten any criticisms from fans of American Apparel? Is there anyone out there sort of defending American Apparel?
Not directly to us. I'm sure that there is somewhere, but they haven't. We most of the letters that we've received have been, you know, supportive of our coverage and the fact that, you know, people are happy that we're not backing down or capitulating to a company just because, you know, okay, we got the date that Dove went to school wrong. It's like, well, we're not going to retract the story for that.
And did you, for those minor corrections, will you be publishing those?
Yeah, we'll put those in the next print issue. When they contacted us and made us aware of those print, of those errors, the magazine was already in print, so we couldn't change those errors. So we'll put those in our next print issue, and since we're quarterly, it'll come out in December.
And do you think, in a way, American Apparel brings more attention to the story through their reaction?
They do, because we wouldn't have publicized it if they hadn't contacted us. We would have, you know, done our normal marketing, which, you know, sending out content to our mailing list and putting out at our website, but we wouldn't have, you know, kind of broadcast the fact that they are pressuring us, you know. So that's kind of brought more attention to the story and to them than would have happened if they had never contacted us.
Even with the problems, are you glad that you put out this issue?
I'm glad because the purpose of doing this whole story was to talk about American Apparel's seedy underside, that they're anti-union, that they objectify women in their advertising, and they have these sexual harassment claims. And, you know, so getting the story out was the whole purpose. You know, our biggest critique is that is kind of this critique of progressive consumerism, that people are ready to kind of like snatch up things just because it says sweatshop free, but not really willing to look beyond that and see, well, is this a company I really want to support?
That is Jen Angel. She's a founder and current co-publisher of Clamor Magazine, which you can find on the web at clamormagazine.org. Their fall issue is now out to subscribers and on newsstands. There's a special section, which is the one that's ticked off American Apparel, because it's about them. Includes articles and includes some, shall we say, critical photo essays, sort of parodying American Apparel's ad style. That special section has actually been posted to the Clamor Magazine website at clamormagazine.org, so you can take a look and read and decide for yourself. And this is Media Geek. In the last minute or so here, I got an interesting little piece about the S hitting the fan, perhaps for our fair president, who swore on live television back in July at the G8 summit that was being held in St. Petersburg, Russia. Apparently, many viewers have complained to the FCC about the president using the S word, then live on TV. Most of them were about a CNN broadcast, which is not subject to FCC fines, because it is cable television, not broadcast television. But apparently one viewer of WCSH-TV in Portland, Maine, which is an NBC affiliate, has complained. This viewer writes, quote, "Every other story I saw on TV and heard on the radio earlier today had the word bleeped. I'm not trying to be a prude. Okay, maybe I am, but I expect more from my local news station," end quote. And according to the FCC's last round of fines they issued earlier this year, the S word, referring to excrement, is never permissible between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m. The FCC ruled, in fact, that the word is so heinous that there is no context in which it can or should be aired, which would not garner a fine. So it leaves it to the FCC. Will they be willing to fine a station for airing the comments of our very own President Bush without a bleep? Will be an interesting thing to see how that comes down. And in other FCC news, the comment deadline for the FCC's proceeding on reviewing media ownership rules is September 22nd. As we hit the beginning of September, we've still yet to hear from the FCC about any of the reports that they're going to issue, detailing analysis about media ownership, and also we haven't heard about any of the proposed new rules. What does the FCC propose to change things, or what does Chairman Kevin Martin want to change things to? Also, the FCC has not scheduled any of the public fora that Chairman Martin said they were going to schedule, six of them, to educate the public and hear from the public. So here we are with, for less than 22 days until the comment deadline on this proceeding, and we have no inkling about what the FCC wants to do officially, none of the research, and we won't be hearing from them in any fora, at least none that have been announced yet. So we'll see. Is this true public input, or is it just a sham? That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at Radio.MediaGeek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at MediaGeek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowe. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.